I'm John Strum, and this is Real Talk MS. It's September 8th, and we have a lot to talk about. And we have a lot going on this week as well. ECTRIMS is an acronym for the European Committee for Treatment and Research in Multiple Sclerosis. And each year, the annual ECTRIMS conference is the largest MS research conference in the world. This year, the European Committee for Treatment and Research in Multiple Sclerosis is partnering with ACTRIMS, the Americas Committee for Treatment and Research in Multiple Sclerosis, to produce MS Virtual 2020, and it gets underway this Friday, September 11th. For obvious reasons, this is going to be a virtual conference, but you can still expect special bonus episodes of Real Talk MS, bringing you the announcements, news, and interviews from MS Virtual 2020. And the evening before the MS Virtual 2020 conference, I hope you're planning to join me at Keep Moving Forward, a benefit event celebrating the MS movement. Keep Moving Forward will begin moving forward this Thursday, September 10th, with the pre-show starting at 7:30 p.m. Eastern Time. You can find out more by visiting msbenefit2020.givesmart.com, and you'll find that link in today's show notes. My guest today is Dr. Scott Newsom, an associate professor of neurology and director of neurosciences consultation and infusion center at Johns Hopkins Medicine. Dr. Newsom also serves as a co-director of the Multiple Sclerosis Experimental Therapeutics Program at Johns Hopkins. Disease-modifying therapies should be the cornerstone of any effective MS treatment plan. But with more than 20 approved prescription medications available today, the choices can seem overwhelming to someone who's just been diagnosed. People living with MS have questions. Do you start out with a safe but less effective medication? Or do you hit MS hard with a high-efficacy drug that may carry more risks? What's the right time to consider switching medications, and how do you have that conversation with your neurologist? Do things like other health conditions affect which disease-modifying therapy you're on? And what about aging? In fact, there are so many important questions surrounding the subject of disease-modifying therapies that this week, I'm devoting this entire episode of Real Talk MS to my conversation about disease-modifying therapies with Dr. Newsom. So in a moment, we'll meet my guest, Dr. Scott Newsom. My guest today is Dr. Scott Newsom. Dr. Newsom is an associate professor of neurology and director of Neurosciences Consultation and Infusion Center at Johns Hopkins Medicine. Dr. Newsom also serves as the co-director of the Multiple Sclerosis Experimental Therapeutics Program at Johns Hopkins, and his main research focuses on helping identify and test novel therapies and therapeutic strategies in multiple sclerosis. Today, we're talking about what I consider to be the cornerstone of any effective MS treatment plan, and that's disease-modifying therapy. Welcome to the podcast, Dr. Newsom.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
There are, I think, 20 approved MS disease-modifying therapies available today, and that list is about to grow once again. And this large number of options can sometimes create a large number of questions for someone trying to figure out their best course of treatment. So I'm hoping that we can shed some light and provide some answers to some of those questions. And I guess I'll start with a question that almost always crosses the mind of someone living with MS. If someone has no evident disability and only mild disease activity, do they need to be on a disease-modifying therapy?
Yeah, that's a wonderful question. We get this often in the clinic. And what I usually say and how I approach this is that, you know, MS is an autoimmune condition. And what we've learned over the years with MS and other autoimmune conditions that it really does need to be treated. This concept of mild or benign MS is really tough to tell with the person sitting in front of you in clinic, meaning that these are what we call retrospective diagnoses, where you don't really know until someone's had the disease for a long time and you see how it plays out. And so the majority of people, based on studies and based on my personal experience, will develop problems related to their MS when they're not treated. And so it's really critical to start someone on a medication, especially those that have relapsing onset MS after a diagnosis has been made. And the reason being is we want to keep people doing what they love to do in life. We want to keep them as functional as possible, as able-bodied as possible. And I think with the expanded armamentarium of disease-modifying therapies that we have, we're seeing that. And it's really an incredible time to be an MS specialist because of the therapies we have. And I do feel like we're helping people in a different way than what we did in years past. And I can attribute a lot of that to the disease-modifying therapy.
I'm hoping you'll explain what we mean when we talk about lower risk, lower or mild efficacy disease-modifying therapies, and what we mean when we talk about high efficacy disease-modifying therapies.
Absolutely. Yeah, because this comes up all the time. And, you know, again, going back to what I mentioned, being in a good position where we have all these therapies, the challenge is, well, which therapy or therapeutic strategy is best for that individual that's sitting in front of you. And certainly, we don't have all the answers as yet. But when we define what is high efficacy versus modest efficacy, low efficacy, it really is based on the pivotal clinical trials that these medications were in, which eventually got them to be FDA approved. And so in clinical trials, you know, for the audience, I'm sure many of you know this, that there are certain markers that we look at to see if a medication is successful in doing what we want it to do versus, let's say, placebo or an active comparator, another medication. And so, let's say a relapse rate or its impact on MRI is impacted in a greater way than, let's say, maybe an older therapy, they often are, like those therapies are often binned into being high efficacy. Now, I do want to caution, though, people in putting too many labels on these medications, because I certainly have seen people do well on really any of the therapies that we have currently available, even those that would be deemed low efficacy. And the averages that we see within clinical trials in terms of relapse reduction or average decrease in new MRI lesion activity, those are averages. And basically, averages are there because there were people that did extremely well and those that did not. And so for a given individual, a low efficacy or a high efficacy could be perfect for them. And that's where the shared decision-making comes into play with the individual that's sitting in front of you, until we have more data that can drive the decisions that we have with respect to treatment strategies. And there are a couple large trials, one of which we're spearheading, called the Treat MS trial, that is looking at, does it really make a difference what we do up front with someone who has relapsing onset MS from a treatment strategy perspective, meaning if you start someone on the heavy hitter, the high efficacy drug, based on the clinical trial data we have, versus those that maybe had less of an impact on relapses and MRI activity in the pivotal trials, does that make a difference for long-term prevention of disability? Because we don't know, actually. We don't know. And maybe we'll find out at the end of this study, and also the Deliver MS study that is being spearheaded by Cleveland Clinic, that the impact on future disability is the same amongst the treatment strategy. And that would be important to know, because obviously the individual medications or treatment approaches come with different levels of side effects. And so we really, really need to, I think, answer some of these important questions in order to help our patients moving forward.
Well, you've mentioned a couple of different treatment strategies, one of which you're involved in a trial that's testing right now. They kind of fall into being referred to as an escalation strategy or an induction strategy. Can you help us understand what each of these treatment philosophies or strategies actually mean?
Absolutely. I would say that for many years and still, the most popular treatment strategy is the escalation treatment strategy approach, which means that someone starts on, let's say, a lower potent medication based on clinical trials and is on it for a period of time and has some breakthrough activity, whether it's relapse, you know, new relapses, new spots on MRI, combination thereof. And then they switch to a more potent therapy, again, thinking about the clinical trials, maybe going on a medication that has shown in clinical trials to have a greater impact on preventing relapses. And then let's say they don't do well on that medication. Say they have continued disease activity. Then they will escalate to the next tier of therapies and maybe, you know, again, it's based on the clinical trial data. So just to make maybe it a little bit easier to understand, at least for myself, you know, the common treatment approach is someone starts on a self-administered injectable and say they're adherent to it, but a year down the road, they start to notice that their MS is not doing well. Then they switch to an oral therapy and say the same thing happens down the road. Then they switch to an infusion therapy or one of the more effective oral therapies. So that's what the escalation treatment approach means. It's almost like going up the stairs, so to speak. Induction therapy, and there's probably different ways to explain this, but an induction therapy is almost like taking a big hammer to the immune system and having that big hammer have a more durable effect on the immune system where you don't have to continuously give a medication like, say, the self-administered injectable or the oral therapy that's given every day, where you can give the therapy up front, and because it has a more durable impact on the immune system, you don't have to repeat that treatment for quite a long time, if you even need to repeat it, which my bias is that no matter how big the hammer is, short of a cure, you will need to intervene later down the road with some other therapy. But it allows some people to get away with not having to do as frequently administered therapy up front when you have an induction treatment. Now, we have to be cautious, though, in part because, again, going back to what I mentioned, does it make a difference what you do up front from a treatment strategy perspective for the long-term benefit? We have learned that starting a more potent therapy for some people could influence actually how we treat people moving forward, meaning that we may have less choices moving forward if someone starts on that induction therapy path. And sure, we don't have the time to go into the nuances of that, but it is very, very important, at least from my perspective, to work with the clinician, to work with the patient and have that shared decision making. What is the best treatment strategy for that individual with the data that we have today? And be okay with stepping back and saying, okay, well, we didn't get it right. We need more work to be done to be able to figure out, can we get it right from that first go? And just being mindful of, well, the good news is we have other treatment strategies or treatment options that we can go towards if we didn't get it right that first or even second time. And where I'm really excited is the two studies I had mentioned, the Treat MS trial and the Deliver MS trial. I think they're going to shed some light into that burning question of, does it make a difference what we do up front? It's not going to answer all questions, but I think it's going to give us a good amount of information to help people down the road.
You know, I think you already started answering my next question. When someone's been diagnosed with MS, one of the things they don't know is which treatment strategy or philosophy their neurologist might favor. And conversely, their neurologist often doesn't know what that particular patient's goals, values, or appetite for risk is. So what's the conversation that has to happen to get the patient and their treating physician on the same page?
Absolutely. You bring up an incredibly important topic. And, you know, for those that know me and have heard me speak before surrounding disease-modifying therapies, what I'm very passionate about is that, you know, you have to really work with the person. It's a shared decision. Regardless of whether that shared decision is weighted one way or the other, the best medication for the individual is the one that they'll take, right? And so we all have different risk tolerances. And so we have to keep that in mind. We also have to keep in mind, what are the short-term goals for the individual? What are the long-term goals? What are family planning, situations that may arise? For both men and women. So this is not just exclusive to one gender. And so it really is, at least in my view, an open and transparent dialogue back and forth that has to ensue. And at least in my practice, when we see people for the first time, we don't really get into the nitty-gritty of disease-modifying therapies or the nuances of, what can happen with X drug versus Y drug. We first get to know each other as people, as partners in crime, so to speak, where we're going to, work together with this journey moving forward, collaborating or being the first individual who's saying, yes, I feel that this is MS. Then we look at, what type of MS does this individual have? Because I do think that that's important. That sets the stage for our conversations about what are our expectations for the disease-modifying therapy that we may or may not move towards. And then we bring the person back after laying that groundwork and have a more nitty-gritty conversation about, okay, well, yes, this is what you have, and where should we go with this? And that, I'd have to say that the other in parallel, just as important, as the disease-modifying therapies, is treating the symptoms that someone is afflicted with. Because we know that when we think about quality of life is probably more important to people because they're dealing with the day-to-day fatigue, day-to-day numbness and tingling, where, that's what's affecting their quality of life the most versus, oh, great, look, their MRI is stable, and I've heard this all many times in the clinic. I get enthusiastic about, oh, it looks like everything's stable from my perspective. And then the person sitting in front of me says, well, the fatigue is wiping me out. I can't do anything with my children. I can't do anything with my spouse. And so that is, I think, maybe even more important in some instances than the disease-modifying therapies. But I know it's long-winded. The fact of it is, though, is we have to really work with the person in front of us and be okay with stepping back from time to time to make sure that this is the appropriate treatment path that someone's on. And can we tweak things here and there that may optimize and improve the quality of life, which could be just as simple as trying to focus on healthy lifestyle choices, exercise, stop smoking, get your other comorbidities under better control. And so, again, that's just as important as making the big decisions around which disease-modifying therapy someone should start on or switch to if they're not having success with the initial one.
do you think that open and transparent dialogue that you just talked about, the one that takes place between the patient and their treating physician, do you think that is happening often enough outside of, say, a leading academic medical institution like the one that your practice is based in?
Yeah, wow, that is a a loaded question in a good way. So obviously there may be some biases in what I'm going to say, because I am here at Hopkins, and I think that we have the fortune to be able to spend time with our patients, even though we certainly have Big Brother, so to speak, looking over our shoulders to make sure that we see enough people. But I do feel like we have probably greater flexibility than maybe our private practice, counterparts. And so we can spend a lot of time with our patients, which even if one is under a bigger microscope from a time perspective, I would say that early on, when you're establishing a relationship with a person with MS or another neurological condition, spending even just a little extra time during those initial encounters goes a long way. And I found that at least in my practice. And I tell, trainees, like residents, fellows, medical students, that it's okay to spend a little extra time with your patients. And yeah, maybe you're perpetually running behind, but guess what? Over time, the person that you're working with, if you're running behind, they know, well, you know what? Dr. Newsom spent this much time with me the first several encounters, and I know he's doing the same with the individual that has the appointment before me. And so I think you have to set that precedent up front that you're willing to spend time with people. Maybe you have to bring a person back to discuss other things in a short follow-up, because there's just a lot of things that one has to talk about, especially during these first several encounters after you make the diagnosis. And so I do feel like in academia, we likely do have a little more time than people out in the community, but that doesn't excuse people from spending extra time with their patients. And there are a lot of different ways you can connect with people. It's not just face-to-face. It could be telephone calls. It could be now with telemedicine. You could use your team to help with that, whether it's a nurse, whether it's a physician extender. So there's a lot of different ways that we can have different touch points to improve the care for our patients. And I think of it from this perspective. If your loved one or close friend or whoever it was seeing a physician for a condition, wouldn't you want that clinician that's helping take care of the loved one or you to spend time with you, the appropriate amount of time with you or your loved one for your care? And I guarantee you, across the board, every clinician would say, absolutely. Is that being done in practice abroad and ubiquitously? Probably not. But I always try to keep that in the back of my mind. And again, I'm biased. I'm in a position where I can spend more time with patients. I also, for those that don't know my background, my mother had MS, and I saw lack of time and just shuttling someone through a clinic can do to an individual. And so I've really taken that to heart and tried to do my best to not replicate that, not repeat the past.
Well, switching gears just a little bit, as a reminder to our listeners, comorbidities are other health conditions that someone might have in addition to MS. As examples, diabetes could be a comorbidity, cardiovascular disease or obesity could be comorbidities. And my question is, should comorbidities be considered in determining the best MS therapy for an individual?
Absolutely. And this has become more apparent with the expanding therapies we have, with that, you know, affect not just the immune system, but can affect what we call off-target organs, whether it's the heart, the lungs, et cetera. And so we absolutely take these things into consideration when we try to figure out what may be the best medication or treatment strategy for an individual. And so if someone has one of the comorbidities like you mentioned, I can think of a few different medicines that I would not steer someone towards. And that's really from a safety perspective. The other thing that is highly critical for people living with MS and for clinicians who are treating people living with MS is that it is just as important to get those comorbidities under control. Because what we've learned here recently is that if someone has poorly controlled diabetes or hypertension, that that actually negatively impacts the MS and can make MS worse. And so we really encourage people to get their other comorbidities under optimal control. And how one does that is not just about the medications, right? We really emphasize healthy lifestyle choices, exercise, stop smoking if you're smoking, and taking your vitamin D, you know, which we know has an impact, a favorable impact on MS. And so all of the things are very, very important. Now, does that mean that, let's say, you look at a medication that may have a potential side effect that could impact another medical condition, and you say, well, we can't start that? No, that's not necessarily true. The example I give is that there are a couple of medications that can cause high blood pressure or maybe make high blood pressure worse. And so a lot of our patients have high blood pressure, right? And so it doesn't mean that I'm not going to consider that medication that has that within the side effect profile. It just means that we need to pay closer attention, I think, to making another medical condition worse by what we do, right? But I do think it's incredibly important to take those factors into consideration.
We're seeing an increasing percentage of people with MS growing older. And there's some question in people's minds about whether it makes sense for someone who's 60, 65, or 70 years old to continue their disease-modifying therapy. What do we know about the effectiveness or the usefulness of disease-modifying therapies as people age?
Wonderful question. This is something that we're grappling with right now. I mean, it's a bit of a debate. It's really a gray area from where I sit. If you look at the clinical trials that eventually led to the approval of the therapies we have today, the majority of those clinical trials have a cutoff, right? All of them have a cutoff in terms of who they will allow into the clinical trial from an age perspective. And the majority are not into the sixth, seventh decade. In fact, all of them, right? And so we don't know. We actually do not know the answer as of yet. What I can say is that there's a couple of fundamental rules, at least that I think about. So one is that as we get older, the immune system is not as robust. It's not as active. And this means that for people with autoimmune conditions, MS included, that actually works in the person's favor. So maybe it's an opportunity to look at, well, if someone is on one of those more potent immune therapies, maybe you can quote-unquote high-efficacy drugs, maybe there's an opportunity to do what's called de-escalate. So maybe switch to a therapy that has less of a impact on the immune system, where maybe there's less risk associated with that, a particular medication that you're de-escalating to because of the age impact for safety. I would say that short of a cure, I would be very, very hesitant and cautious to just stop all therapies together, at least for those that have relapsing MS. It's a little bit more challenging when we think about progressive MS, especially progressive MS where there's not any recent signs of inflammatory activity, meaning relapse and these spots on the MRI that have developed recently. And so we do have to really, again, be transparent with our patients and say, well, do we think that based on what we know with the therapy you're on, that this is really impacting any of the progressive part of your disease? Because if we look at the majority of therapies we have today, I would say their most robust impact is on the inflammatory part of the disease, so shutting down inflammation, which we hope and we have seen can translate into preventing future disability, but it doesn't do that for all people, and there can still be progression in the setting of shutting down inflammation. And I've had a couple instances, which albeit not often, where there is that shared decision to stop a medication and not start another medicine. And in some individuals, that has led to reactivation of their MS. So I think we do have to take that in consideration. I'll just have one more example. I just saw a person in clinic who was the second time that I saw them. They're in their 80s. They're on a self-administered injectable therapy, which they've been on for more than 2 decades. And they haven't had any recent relapses, no new spots in MRI. They're having some progression in their weakness, becoming more weak. And the question this week was, well, should I stop my medication? I'm running out of areas to inject. If I stop it, do I hold it and not go on another therapy? And so we had a very transparent conversation about what we know, what we don't know. And the decision is still up in the air in terms of what the path will be moving forward. So more to come, though. You know, there are studies looking at this question, and so I'm hopeful in the near future we'll have more evidence behind some of the things that we do in the clinic.
Well, Dr. Scott Newsom, on a recent podcast, we talked about the value and importance of increasing your health literacy. I think you've helped us do that today. I want to thank you for all you do to improve the lives of people living with MS, and thanks for talking with me today.
Thank you. This has been fantastic. And thank you for all what you do as well in bringing awareness to people with MS and then those that are helping them through their journey.
That's going to wrap up this episode of Real Talk MS. Real Talk MS is powered by the National MS Society. And you can share this episode of the podcast by letting your friends or family members know that all they have to do is point their web browser at realtalkms.com/158. And you'll find that link in today's show notes, so you can easily copy and paste it right into your email or your text. And before we close things out, I'd like to invite you to leave a rating and review for Real Talk MS. I found a way to make it super easy for you to leave a rating and review, and I'm hoping some of you won't mind taking a moment to do that. Here's how simple it is. If you point your browser at realtalkms.com/review, you'll see links to the different online destinations that you can choose from to leave that rating and review. And those links are based upon the software that you happen to be using or the platform that you're on to listen to podcasts. For instance, if you happen to be using an Android phone to listen to Real Talk MS, you won't find a link to leave a rating and review on Apple Podcasts, because you can't leave a review on Apple Podcasts if you're using an Android phone. I hope that makes sense. It's just a little bit of technology that makes leaving a rating and review really easy. So if you have a spare moment, it would mean a lot to me if you visit realtalkms.com/review, click on one of the online destinations that you see, and leave a rating and review for Real Talk MS. And you'll find that link in today's show notes. I don't think that I have to tell anyone listening to this podcast that the COVID-19 pandemic has intensified and in some cases multiplied the challenges of living with MS, from having difficulty affording MS medications, to adjusting to increased isolation, to coping with the added uncertainty of wondering how you or your family might be personally affected by COVID-19. More than ever before, people living with MS need access to reliable information, support, and connection. We're witnessing that even during a pandemic, MS doesn't stop, and neither does the National MS Society. So they've established the National MS Society COVID-19 Response Fund to ensure that the Society can continue meeting the urgent and expanding needs of the MS community during these unprecedented times. During the pandemic, we've seen the MS Society create virtual programming and support groups literally on the fly, so that no one has to face MS alone. They've created resources and provided information so that doctors and nurses can deliver the very best care. They've continued to amplify the voices of the MS movement to influence critical public policy decisions, and they've never stopped advancing research to find cures for MS. I know these are financially challenging times for a lot of people, but I'm asking that as you're able, please make a donation to support the National MS Society. To donate, just text the word GIVE to 68686, and you'll get a link right to the MS Society's COVID-19 Response Fund webpage. I hope you'll contribute today, because it's never been more important. I'm John Strum. Thanks for listening. Stay safe and make healthy choices.